You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 3rd to the 9th of September 2015. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook, news editor Simon Baker and reporter Chris Havergal. Support staff are in the majority at 71% of UK higher education institutions. Is this good? Is it bad? It's certainly something, and it's certainly a bone of contention for some. More on that in just a second. Karen's here to give us a lowdown of this week's books section, and Chris is here to discuss access. Are universities' efforts to improve access for students from disadvantaged areas being hampered by too much focus on these areas and not on individuals? And on a similar topic, could Germany's abolition of tuition fees be a model for the UK? No, is the short answer to that one. According to the Higher Education Policy Institute, Chris will elaborate a little bit more. I think it needs some elaboration a bit later on. But first, Simon. This is a story by Paul Jump, our splash this week. He's not with us. You're the news editor, perfectly placed to comment on it. Support staff in universities. Paul's been crunching a lot of figures, and he's found out that, generally speaking, academics are a minority in our universities.
Well, the concern's been raised in the past about the kind of growth of support staff over academics. And, you know, while, you know, obviously support staff are very important to universities, this is something that was kind of pointed out, we mentioned in the article by Benjamin Gainsburg, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, sort of in a book in 2011, raised this issue about overbearing administration at universities. So we've looked at the HESA figures on this just to kind of give an actual picture of what is the proportion of support staff at UK universities, and then could leave people to discuss and the merits of that, whether it's that's a good thing or a bad thing. But essentially what it's found is that support staff are in the majority at most universities, 71% in fact. If you then kind of look at the spread of institutions, there's, we've looked at those that have, there's a few that have over 60% proportion of support staff. Most of those that are kind of in that kind of 71%, I suppose, or over the 50% mark, there are a few over the 60%.
Yeah, we've done just to interrupt, so the top 10 is available online in this story and in the magazine as well. Bradford 62%, Wolverhampton 62%, Durham 61% to give you the top three.
Well, I should point out that's looking at the largest campuses, so we've excluded institutions with fewer than 500 academic staff to come up with that top 10. I mean, the institution, according to the HESA data, has the highest proportion of support staff is the London Business School, 85%. But as I said, there was, as you get more towards the smaller institutions, then you're more likely to kind of have figures which go towards the extreme, I suppose, and may need some sort of explanation or reasons behind it. We also looked at kind of if you obviously support staff means covers a lot of job roles. It may also include a lot of blue-collar jobs, tradespeople, ground staff, that kind of thing. So we've also looked at white-collar proportions as well and taken those out just to sort of get more of an idea about the proportion of administrative staff, if that's what the concern is, if there is a concern by people. And that kind of, sort of we looked at those figures, and that shows some interesting outliers there as well. As compared with some of the institutions that have the smallest proportions of support staff, the actual smallest was the Institute of Cancer Research, even for a big, they're counted as a big institution at 37%. So there was quite a big difference between those with a high proportion and those at a low. So I'm sure it's going to prompt a bit of discussion about whether that is a good thing or not.
Absolutely. Well, there is more of that discussion on page 6 and 7 in the story this week. You'll find it on timeshighereducation.co.uk. as well, of course. Books, Karen, moving on. What do you have for us this week?
Well, gloriously, I got an extra 3 reviews in this week. Every few weeks I get a couple of extra pages, which allowed me to include a review of a book called American Zoo, A Sociological Safari. The author of this book spent years volunteering at U.S. zoos and visiting dozens more. He was extremely thorough, even took it upon himself to taste the food of all the animals he worked with. A herbivore, though, not those that ate maggots. Apparently, at one of the things he observed is that people who own chinchilla coats like to pet the chinchillas. Spectators ask to ride the giraffes or have the penguins help them propose. And at one zoo where they had, at a prominent aquarium, after you finish looking at the marine life, you can have oysters on the half shell, pink shrimp, Dungeness crab, and clam chowder. And if you think you're being witty, you are not the first person to say, by the way, does this seafood come from those tanks over there? Everyone asks that. Also this week, Monica Krauss reviews Lisa Malke's book called The Need to Help, The Domestic Arts of International Humanitarianism. Malke looks at aid workers, in this case, Finnish aid workers in the developing world, not from the perspective of what they're doing for other people, but what their motivations are, and a lot of it has to do with, well, she talks to them about how it fulfills their own needs. It doesn't portray them as selfish or self-interested, but it, our reviewer says it's a way toward acknowledging people's motivations and what they get from it psychologically. Thomas Piketty, he's on the rise. You may have heard of him. I'm still not sure if it's Piketty. As soon as I say Piketty, I feel that it probably is Piketty. He is indeed the man who wrote the giant book Capital in the 21st Century, which last year everyone claimed they were reading in the over the summer holidays. I'm not sure they did. So for those of you who did not manage to get your way through that genre-defining book, here's one he wrote earlier. It's a lot shorter, 160 pages long. And Victoria Bateman reviews it and asks what it tells us about his specialist subject. And indeed, the title is very clear on his specialist subject, The Economics of Inequality. Her judgment is that it's probably quite useful about France, maybe not the kind of cheap version to his theories, but still of use. Howard Segal reviews Kate Brown's book, Dispatches from Dystopia, Histories of Places Not Yet Forgotten. If you thought your summer holiday was a washout, well, you might want to look at this one and be sure next year not to go to Karaganda, a Russian gulag city of mines in Kazakhstan, the author's hometown of Elgin, Illinois, in the middle of the Rust Belt, or Chernobyl in the Ukraine.
Sounds like a very badly planned cycling holiday.
Indeed, indeed, yes. However, it was for research. It was not a terrible accident. And this week's Book of the Week by Kieran Burke was his doctoral work for the Society for Research into Higher Education. The book is called Culture, Capitals, and Graduate Futures, Degrees of Class. He did research on graduates of the two universities in Northern Ireland and looked at what happened to them after they graduate, after they graduated, how they did, how their attitudes from before they were at university affected and their experiences affected what happened to them later. Our reviewer, Hugh Morris, is a visiting professor at the University of Salford, but he's also director of Skills, Higher Education and Lifelong Learning for the Welsh Government. So he looks at this sort of issue all the time. He thinks Burke's book is a really useful addition to the body of research on graduate futures, especially since prior to this, most of the studies were done focusing on graduates of elite universities or at larger urban universities. There hasn't been so much work done on people from working class and middle class backgrounds at mid-ranking universities. And Morris says the main conclusion Burke draws is that early experiences of class before university study have a long-standing impact on working lives long after you leave university, particularly if you're from groups like the strategic middle class, where you and your parents think strategically about what you should be doing to bolster your CV when you're young, or in contrast, the converted working class who have worked their way up, the entitled middle class who sit around waiting for a good job to come to them, apparently, research suggests, or the static working class. So adds to the corpus of work on graduate futures.
Interesting stuff. Thank you, Karen. Speaking of Northern Irish institutions, we're following developments at the University of Ulster and Queen's in our news pages, or I should say in the news section online. Ulster, as we record this, has just announced, Chris, I believe, that it's to close its School of Computing and other departments.
It's the School of Modern Languages closing, but there's also a number of other departments which it's identified for rationalisation, an ominous term. That includes maths, computing and business management. Obviously, if we're talking about graduate employment prospects, and indeed the Northern Ireland economy in general, those are some key areas where if you're thinking that people would be doing well after university, those are the sorts of subjects they'd be needing to be taking. So some concerning announcements there, all brought on by the cuts from the Northern Ireland Executive.
Yeah, and those cuts also inspired a blog by Trina Vargo, who works at the Mitchell Scholarship Programme, which no longer includes Northern Irish universities following those developments. You can read that blog on our blog section. You can read Chris's news in our news section, timeshighereducation.co.uk. A bit of housekeeping, the THE Awards 2015 shortlist is unveiled in this week's magazine. Do have a look there. I hope your institution is nominated. And I should also flag up our cover feature, in which Paul Jump, again, who, as I mentioned, is not here. In our cover feature, he talks about the difficulty of reproducing the results of scientific experiments. It's a big piece of work, a bit of a labour of love, I recall Paul himself saying, but do read that from page 42 in this week's magazine too. Chris, before we go, Access, you've been writing a couple of pieces about some, that sort of general area. First of all, are universities' efforts to improve access for students from disadvantaged areas in the UK being hampered by focusing too much on areas?
They are, according to a study which we feature in this week's magazine. There's a number of ways in which you can identify students who could be considered to be disadvantaged or targets for universities' widening participation activities. You could look at an area where they live, but you could also look at things like parents' occupation, ethnicity, eligibility for free school meals, etc. What the study led by Neil Harrison at the University of the West of England finds is that it's area data on low participation neighbourhoods, which is used by almost all of the UK's higher education providers. Even though more than half of the institutions that responded to a survey he carried out had concerns about its precision. What it appears to indicate is that it's being used very widely, and indeed much more widely than the other categories, which may be more precise. It's being used more widely because it's available, it's easy for universities to get their hands on, and also it fits into the sort of national verifiable sets of data which universities have to set targets relating to for the Office for Fair Access. So there are a couple of very interesting findings in the survey which is perhaps worth just flagging up. 60% of respondents felt that increasing applications from disadvantaged areas and schools would be as big a success or bigger than increasing applications from disadvantaged individuals. 53% said recruiting an advantaged student from a disadvantaged area would be as good or better than recruiting a disadvantaged student from an advantaged neighbourhood. So suggesting that some of these targets may be having a slightly perverse impact on universities' access activities.
I've heard of house prices being pushed up in areas by parents trying to move their students into good catchment areas for school. Maybe now we'll see them moving into disadvantaged areas in the hope that they can get into a good university.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, we've also, the other issue that we talk about with One Access is fees, and whether fees could have an impact on people from poorer backgrounds going to universities. And so that's why it's perhaps useful also to mention another piece in the magazine this week, which looks at Germany as a potential model for the UK in that regard. Germany has abolished tuition fees, and there's a lot of campaigners who say, well, the UK should follow suit. And this week we feature a report by the Higher Education Policy Institute, which takes a look at this argument and says, well, actually, the German higher education system is so different to the UK higher education system. In particular,
it's free for a start.
Well, yes, yeah, quite different. Quite different.
In particular, there are only sort of about half of the states in Germany that ever charged fees. They were typically very low, €1,000 a year. And that the German state never paid that much itself towards per student funding in universities. So they're saying it's not really comparable. So if we're looking at widening access, looking at fees and looking at Germany, probably isn't the way to go.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you, Chris. All of those stories that we've discussed are available on timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find all of the book reviews under the books tab as well. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. You'll find us on Google+ as well. Please do let us know your thoughts. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.